The content of this program is meant for educational purposes only, because knowledge is power. However, the controversial subject matter discussed may not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, staff, or its advertisers. Change only happens when we, the people, become part of the solution. That's why more and more patriotic Americans are tuning in to the Power Hour. Now, here's your host, Dave Krieger.
And it's high noon here where we are, where Matt Vadim is. It's probably 1 o'clock in the afternoon because he is the Washington reporter. He's based out of D.C. He is the reporter for the United States Supreme Court. He reports for the Epoch Times. Some of you say Epoch Times, you know. It's an epic moment, whichever the case may be. Matt Vadim, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So the thing is that when I picture all these reporters trying to get the scoop, which it seems like this is what we're trying to do these days, they don't sit down and deliberate over what they're going to put into writing. They just write as fast as they can. To me, every time I see reporters rushing out of the court, it's like that movie Airplane when all the reporters go running for the phone booths to get on the phone to call it in, and the whole phone booth wall just falls over. That's the sort of thing, the picture that I get, the visual I get. And see, because like I said before we went on the air, is that people need to deliberate. This country's out of control. There's a lot of things going on right now. And since you are a Supreme Court reporter, you can clearly see by the tone and the means by which the questions are posited when the court grants a writ of certiorari. And folks, if you don't know what that is, there's lots and lots of writs that are submitted to the court that are basically refused. They deny them. They won't hear them. They get to pick and choose their cases. They narrowly rule on them. Would that be a fair statement, Matthew?
Yeah, almost all petitions for certiorari, which is a fancy word for review, are rejected by the Supreme Court, almost all of them. So very small percentage of them make it to the oral argument stage.
So when they get there to the oral argument stage, most of the time, if a writ is accepted, does it have to go before a hearing orally?
No. The Supreme Court, but then the Supreme Court gets criticized for putting something on the so-called shadow docket and not having an oral argument. It does not have to have a hearing. It can dispose of a petition for certiorari. It can dispose of it summarily if it wishes, if it's clear cut, or if there was just a case recently that was on point, that was close enough to it. They can just grant the petition and then grant a judgment and send the case back to the lower court, you know, or whatever the case may be, to reconcile its decision with the Supreme Court's precedent. So, no, they don't always, when they grant the petition, they don't always have an oral argument. They usually do, most cases, but sometimes they don't. They have a GVR, the lawyers call it, a grant, vacate, and remand. And sometimes they'll hold cases up in reserve and just wait. They know that they got this bunch of cases that are similar enough to something that they're dealing with, so they will just put them on hold, put them on pause, not do anything with them, and then once they hand down their decision, then there'll be a stream of these grant, vacate, and remands, and they'll send them back to the lower courts to decide.
Right. Now, I'm just wondering, I didn't even know about the shadow docket, but apparently there is one. I'm not even sure that our listeners even knew that. But now that you've explained it, see, when you get people with boots on the ground, folks like Matt, that has been there, that sees all this, do you ever, as a reporter, get to talk to the justices directly?
No, never.
Wow. But you basically, all you're doing, you're an observer.
Unless you go to some gala event where they're the guest speaker and they open the floor to questions. But, usually the people attending the event are going to crowd out the reporters. Mm-hmm. Normally, you don't get to speak to justices ever. Unless they're selling a book or something like that and having
a- Well, see now, but the thing is, Matt, is that Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito just gave speeches. Were they part of like ceremonial commencements? That's what I understand. Is that true?
One, I think Alito was attending a private Catholic university commencement. The name of the place escapes me. It might have been in Indiana. And I'm not sure, though, maybe. And then Justice Thomas was attending a retreat for judges in the 11th Circuit, his home circuit, you know, which is Georgia and nearby states, you know, a retreat where, you know, judges were getting together and, I don't know, comparing notes and bonding and breaking bread together.
Interesting how that works.
Two different settings. Yeah, well, they do that. Just like any other profession, right? They get together and have retreats. I don't think there's anything necessarily, you know, untoward about that.
Well, no, I agree. And they need to get out and socialize. But we know that this network and a lot of these people that don't trust our system of justice these days refers to it as a good old boy network. I mean, that's what all the naysayers that are pointing fingers at the justice system, you know, including those who want to pack the court versus those who want things just to stay status quo. And then they got the ones that, you know, Trump put up, what, 187 district court judges up there, 187 new judges he got appointed and all this other stuff during his administration and whatnot. I mean, all this it may be relevant, may not be relevant, but the real reason the Supreme Court is there and it's very difficult with what these guys have to do. But have you seen it politically agendized, to use for lack of a better term, as far as the way these judges rule, like this latest case about voting 6-3 for a state to be allowed under the Forfeiture Act to keep innocent owners' cars that unknowingly to them were used in drug crimes? I mean, do you see the deference paid to certain things?
That has a strange inversion, though. That has a lot of people, at least according to the people, and there have been 300 and something comments in the thread on the article, the online version.
Right.
And most people are, even though, you know, I think Epoch Times readers tend to the right side of the political spectrum, most people are agreeing with the liberals, saying that the court should have been more lenient towards the car owners and should have made it more difficult for the state to forfeit, to go through civil asset forfeiture. The case was about whether these two ladies, their cars were used by friends or relatives or whatever, and then drugs were discovered and the cars were seized, and eventually they got the cars back, but they were pissed off at having been deprived of their cars, so they filed class action suits. And it's the class action suits that didn't go very far, and the appellate court wasn't too keen on that. And the judges weren't either. The justices weren't either. They said that the car owners were not entitled to a separate preliminary hearing to determine if the initial seizure of the car was lawful. They said as long as they get a hearing, basically the Supreme Court said as long as they get a hearing, as long as the matter is discussed and they're given due process in the overall context of the civil forfeiture proceeding, then that satisfies the due process clause of the Constitution. Whereas the three liberal justices said, no, they're entitled to more than that. And that's where the disagreement is. And as I said, that's why this sort of strange inversion where a lot of conservatives are actually agreeing with the liberal justices there.
But I mean,
doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen. I don't think that the conservatives were necessarily anti-property rights. I think that the conservatives were saying, you know, going by the book, you know, what the Constitution says, and not trying to read in something to it to help the car owners, and that comes across as, well, cold and unsympathetic to property rights. And it's, you know, it's up to readers to decide if that's, you know, if they are unsympathetic to property rights. But they did rule that, you know, I wouldn't like it if my car was seized, you know.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
I lent it to a relative, a nephew who, you know, who smoked a joint and left it behind in the car. That would make me angry.
Yeah, but he had a gun, too.
Yeah, well, one of the cases, that's right. The person had a gun.
I did read it. So,
right, but I did in Alabama. Alabama carrying a gun in your car—that doesn't strike me as particularly odd. But in any event, yeah.
Now the other thing
they could have done more to advance property rights, but they didn't, and that's what people seem to be miffed about.
Up in arms, yeah. Now the thing is were both of these women were black?
I think they were. You know, it never says in the court papers, I think they were, and that tends to go with the argument that you know, that they were powerless. You know, one's name was Halima Tarifa Cully. So, you know, she might have been Muslim and Arab or something. I'm not really sure. And the other one, I have no idea, name's Lena Sutton. Just looking through my article here.
Sure.
So I don't know if they were black, but you know.
Yeah. That's that thing that we all look at, you know.
Yeah, there's a good chance they were.
Yeah. See, that's the thing about, you know, what we do when we go to the airport and we have to walk through TSA and they profile. And I mean, those are the sorts of things that, you know, I mean, we all look at, you know.
Don't forget about the groping.
Oh, yeah. The groping, too. Yeah.
And that happened for the first time a few months ago. And I was, the guy had suggested, do you want to go in a private room for this? So I said, no. I was in a hurry, right? So, but now maybe next time, private room. I didn't enjoy it.
Wow. So now you, as far as, is this the only major Supreme Court? I mean, you obviously covered Dobbs v. Jackson.
Yeah, the abortion case, right?
And the thing
is, where the conservative wing on the court stuck together, except for Roberts.
Which I don't understand. I mean, people look at him and just kind of like scratching their head trying to figure him out. Have you seen it that way?
Yeah, I absolutely see it that way. He's a very confused individual, in my opinion. And when we're speaking, people, I get attacked all the time, sometimes pretty vigorously, on the comment threads of my own articles, people saying, oh, this guy, Vadim, doesn't know what he's talking about. There's only two conservatives on the Supreme Court, Alito and Thomas. And I see their point, but you know, broadly speaking, you got to use these generalizations to make sense of what the court is doing. And that doesn't mean they all stick together or that they're all conservative. You know, sometimes Kavanaugh is more conservative than Barrett, and sometimes Barrett's more conservative than Kavanaugh. And then sometimes Gorsuch, who's pretty conservative, does wacky things like the Bostock ruling from 4 years ago, finding that gender identity was covered by the Civil Rights Act of 1964 when nobody had even heard of gender identity. I don't think the concept was even invented until the 70s. So, you know, they're not always – you can't always force them into these descriptions. And so, you know, it makes it difficult. But you got to generalize. And you say there's a conservative wing and there's a liberal wing. And that doesn't mean they're all – you know, they're always hardcore conservative. And that doesn't mean the liberals are always hardcore liberal. In fact, most people don't realize that most Supreme Court decisions are unanimous. Okay, it's only the ones where they're not unanimous that you hear about, because that's more interesting. That's more newsworthy. But most of the cases are unanimous. On most things, the justices agree on just about everything. It's only on certain areas where there is an ideological divide, you know, that consistently rears its head.
But how many of them are as a result of circuit splits?
Well, almost all of them are as a result of circuit splits, because rarely does a case come to the court. That's one of the reasons for granting a writ of certiorari is because the federal courts of appeal, the circuits, First Circuit, Second Circuit, you know, all the way up to 11th or circuit, because they don't agree. And so they want to – the Supreme Court wants the law to be consistent across the whole country, because if there's a circuit split, it means the law isn't consistent across the whole country. So they – the Supreme Court feels it has to step in and impose one rule that's to be followed across the whole country.
And that goes for the D.C. Yeah, that goes for the D.C. appellate circuit as well as the federal appellate circuit, which is where most of the patent, trademark, copyright infringement, that sort of thing are heard, is in the federal
circuit. There's other ones, too. There's a tax circuit. There's a veterans circuit. There's a military circuit, armed forces circuit. Mm-hmm. All sorts of other circuits that I rarely deal with. You know, there's some court nobody's ever heard of called the United States Court of Federal Claims. Mm-hmm. And don't ask me what it does. I'm sure it does something valuable, but I don't know what it is.
Wow. Federal claims. You know, it makes me wonder whether or not the federal – but you haven't seen federal tort claims go through those? I mean, do they normally go through channels you're familiar with? People suing the federal government, then you got to go get permission from the court in order to sue the federal government?
Well, you got to get permission from the government, but then there's a legal fiction they can use to get around it called the ex parte Young fiction. That's why when you're looking at a lawsuit, it'll say, you know, that Governor – so-and-so, Governor Smith, is being sued in his official capacity, because otherwise you'd have to get permission from the state as a sovereign entity to sue it. So, yeah, you have all sorts of suits against the government. And, you know, there's usually ways around that.
Sure. You know, back in what's making our front headlines today, which we've been talking about a little bit, is what's been going on in New York City. Letitia James succeeded in getting one of Trump's witnesses, his CPA, to plead out, and now is in jail. And now they paraded Stormy Daniels in the new case, in the criminal case, now that they've whacked on former President Trump up front the first time with this giant size judge imposed, you're guilty, and we're not even having a trial yet. I mean, there's so many reasons that this thing could go up on appeal. And just from that perspective alone, do you see that being reversed by the New York appellates?
Yeah.
The third department.
Yeah, it likely would be. It is a pretty, you know, whatever you think of President Trump, you know, whether you like him or not, or his mean tweets or whatever, I like them sometimes. I have to admit it. But whether you like him or not, the issue is whether he's criminally liable, and I don't think he is. At most, in the accounting, the Stormy Daniels thing isn't. They say it's a hush money case, but that's a grotesque oversimplification. It's about accounting irregularities to disguise the payment to her, to not disclose what, you know, her allegations, to shut her up, which is something that's routinely done by politicians and by prominent people. You know, they pay you money to go away if you make an accusation. It's about an account. It's about a violation. It's like an accounting fraud case. And, you know, at most it's they're misdemeanor charges. So, you know, Hillary Clinton committed all sorts of things and may not have even done it, you know, may not have even done it knowingly. And she filled out forms or she signed forms and didn't disclose things the proper way. And she had to pay fines. So that's normally what happens. But I think the feeling is that with President Trump, you know, he's not normal and they want to nail him. So they took something that would normally be dealt with in a more low-key summary fashion and decided to just go crazy with it and, you know, and bring him in for mugshots and make it into a public spectacle.
Well, so, they did,
you know,
this.
Just like the other case, the E. Jean Carroll case is.
Oh, yeah.
What proof is there? She doesn't even remember when it happened. And, you know, it's bizarre. It's bizarre. And, and then the case with Judge Engeron about what was it about real estate fraud, overvaluing the, you know, his properties, and, you know, a lot of real estate lawyers are like scratching their heads over that. Scratching their heads, saying, Well, when you apply for a bank, you give your estimate. And then if the bank doesn't agree, then they reject that and use their own estimate. And in this case, and it has to be pretty serious for, you know, for fraud to be charged. But in this case, the banks were happy with their customer, President Trump. And you know, from before he became president, when he was a real estate developer, businessman, wheeler and dealer, and they said they'd be happy to do business with him again. So, you know, it's like everybody's happy, but there's this claimed violation. And again, it's the kind of thing that if it were somebody else, it wouldn't have been dealt with in such a high-handed manner. They wouldn't have thrown a national spotlight on it and wow. taken it to perp walked him and gave him a mugshot and taken it to trial. So that's what a lot of this is. And I don't think I'm alone in the legal observer community in feeling this way.
Well, and we've been watching it too. I'm just a paralegal, but I'm also a journalist, and I look at things, try to look at things from all perspective. And there's a lot of things that Trump has done during his administration that I don't necessarily agree with, like Operation Warp Speed, not allowing something like that to be put on the market and falling for those lies from Fauci and Birx and everybody else. I mean, right. That's been big bone of contention.
And then exempting the drug makers from liability.
Yeah, that's I have a hard time with it. But the thing is, I mean, he's paying for that now because people are trying to wrap their heads around this, Matthew, and they have a hard time doing it. But back to this other case, bringing Stormy Daniels in was really irrelevant. And I think they were doing it just to screw with the jury's focus. So they basically would point a finger at him and said, you're a groper and a philanderer and you cheated on your wife and all these other things. I mean, I really think that a lot of these jurors are going to have a very hard time distinguishing between the business records, even though Cohen is taking the stand today. He's already been convicted of perjury in one instance, and he's going to get on the stand and try to attack Trump, and they're going to have a hell of a time impeaching him. But I mean, the thing is when you have a judge that sits up there and said, to the defense team, well, I'm really surprised that you haven't objected more than you did. And I'm like, you can object to the entire line of testimony for crying out loud. And this judge would still allow the trial to go on. Twice he said, no mistrial. So it's going to be up to the jury. I would think if you were a juror in this thing and you're about to change history for the worst, that you would really think twice about convicting a former president, because that opens the door to so many other precedents, wouldn't you think?
Well, the precedent being that other ex-presidents will be able to be prosecuted. And, you know, if President Trump is being prosecuted for these things, there's dozens of things that President Biden could be prosecuted for. And I don't think they realize this precedent opening the door to this will open it, since we're using door metaphors, right? The door is going to slap them in the behind when it shuts, and they are going to regret it, because it's going to open up in a whole new generation of lawfare where politics is continued in the courtroom, you know, after it's been fought at the ballot box and so on.
Well, so and it's
politicizing, it's criminalizing politics, and that's a very dangerous thing to do. You know, it's not like these are Nuremberg tribunals, right? And we're putting hot people on trial. You could put government officials on for war crimes and crimes against humanity, but none of this stuff rises to the level of any of this. Everything that Trump has been accused of are you know, policy disagreements, and then the documents withholding case seems to be falling apart.
But you're switching stuff around, though. That's what they did. They switched markers. They switched evidence labels. I mean, that's evidence tampering in my book, isn't it?
Presidents always take stuff with them, always take crap with them when they leave the White House. And then the National Archive fights with them for years, and there's a back and forth. This is just normal. And they, you know, they reach accommodations. But in Trump's case, you know, they sent a few demand letters He didn't do what they wanted, so they charge him with crimes, and it's pretty crazy. And now it looks like some of the documents may have been planted there, and the one judge had the good sense at least to put that trial on hold for the time being, or at least the process leading to a trial, since it hasn't gone to an actual trial yet, that she's put it on hold. What is her name? Judge Eileen Cannon.
Eileen Cannon, yeah.
In Florida, and she's the federal judge, and she's put that on hold. But, you know, and you're going to – the one in the state prosecution in Georgia for election interference that seems to be dead in the water, at least for the time being, with all the corruption allegations against the district attorney, Fani Willis, and what have you. But, you know, there's still other cases going, and the idea, the thinking, according to my legal sources, is that this is just a political charade, and that the idea is to just keep Trump's name in the spotlight, to keep dumping on him, to not allow him to campaign, and they hope they get a felony conviction, because then they can say, oh, Trump's a felon, he's a criminal, you know, blah blah blah. Nobody should vote for him anymore, and that sort of appeal, that sort of thing would, that argument would appeal to lots of voters. So the idea, even if the charge is doomed to be overturned, the conviction is destined to be overturned later, That's not the point. The point is this is for political consumption. This is for the voters to see and to react against Trump. Instead of judging him based on his record as a president and on his campaign promises and his tweets and what have you, on, you know, what he's actually done, they want to judge him on all these things that are really just attempts to criminalize policy. Disagreements over policy, and you know, the left is really going to regret it, because I suspect if Trump wins, he's going to be vengeful, you know, and it's pretty hard not to blame him. I'm not saying he's going to turn into a tyrant or a dictator or anything like that, but I think he's going to want to settle some scores, and I think his voting base in the Republican Party is going to cheer him on doing that. And, you know, so then this will just lead to a cycle of recriminations. Is this what we're going to do every election? Maybe. Maybe that's just the way it's going to be, and America's going to turn into, like, you know, Brazil or some – I don't know if I'd call Brazil a third world country, but it's definitely not a model of it's definitely not a model of a stable republic.
Right. Banana republic.
Yeah, kind of. It's not like Honduras or anything like that, but it's I wouldn't want to live there.
No, marginal at best. So
judicial dictatorship at the moment.
Yeah, we could go on and have just this real serious conversation down the road, because we're out of time. That's it. Our clock has run out. Matthew Batom, thank you so much. Yes, we're out of time for this segment, and we appreciate you and all the work you're doing to break the news to the people.
Happy to come back anytime you want me.
We will. Thank you. As we start approaching 2024's election cycle, we definitely will. We'll talk soon. Thank you. We'll be right back after these words. Stay with us.
iComplex CS is a comprehensive natural medicine formula to nourish and heal eye tissue formulated by a board-certified MD ophthalmologist, Dr. Robert Abel. Why you need vitamins for your eyesight? There is a direct and proven physiological connection between the nutrients we put into our body and the quality of our eyesight. Some vitamins for eyesight can be absorbed from the food we eat, but other vital nutrients cannot, especially if you're not eating a daily, nutritionally balanced diet. Additional supplements are essential for optimal eye health as well as your overall physical health. With 23 vitamins and nutrients such as N-acetylcysteine, steam, which is important for removing toxic substances from the liver. This, the most complete clinical strength eye and total body multivitamin available in one supplement. Call the Power Mall at 877-817-9829 or order online at thepowermall.com.
Come to the Power Mall today and purchase Mediterranean black seed oil from North American Urban Spice. Exclusively from the genetic source and never standardized. Cold pressed, it's so good it supports cardiovascular, respiratory, immune, digestive, neurologic health, and so much more. Said to be good for everything but death itself, come find the best prices on black seed capsules or 8-ounce varieties when you visit thepowermall.com. Or call 877-817-9829 to purchase.
Hi, this is Jay at the Power Mall. I have a good friend with me here today. She has been taking the calcium bentonite clay that she purchased from the Power Mall for many, many years now. And I asked her to sit with me and explain to the listeners what she uses the clay for.
Thanks. So just to let you know, we use it on a daily basis. I will put a teaspoon of calcium bentonite clay into a glass of water and drink it before bed for detox. We've done weekly foot soaks for my husband who has diabetes. We use it for facials. I use it once a week for my clay bath detox. We've used it on spider bites, insect bites, and I've also used it for the swelling in my ankle after surgery.
Oh, yes, I do remember when you had the surgery. To order the clay, please call 877-817-9829 or go to thepowermall.com.
Boost your immune system naturally this year with oil of oregano, a potent germ killer. This is the true wild oregano oil P73, a blend of edible spices of wild oregano grown on natural mineral-rich soils. Research published in the International Journal of Food Microbiology found that oil of oregano is an excellent germicide capable of killing a wide range of fungi and bacteria. Get it today by visiting thepowermall.com or calling 877-817-9829.
Why invest in all the great natural supplements from the Power Mall and then use a toothpaste loaded with harmful synthetic chemicals like fluoride? You want really healthy checkups, right? People who switch to Vitamir toothpaste and mouthwash are reporting healthy-looking gums and whiter teeth. Both the Vitamir toothpaste and mouthwash are formulated with natural products like zinc, folic acid, cloves, and myrrh. It's nature's answer to preventing plaque, reducing the development of cavities, and promoting healthy teeth and gums. Vitamir toothpaste comes in original formula and also with CoQ10 and xylitol, as well as in a great-tasting orange-flavored children's formula, too. Get Vitamir toothpaste and mouthwash from the Power Mall today, and you, too, can have healthy checkups. Call 877-817-9829. Or order from thepowermall.com.
Many Americans are growing increasingly concerned about the rapidly growing U.S. government deficits. Recognizing the additional printing of paper money devalues U.S. currency. To compensate, American gold and silver coins will provide wealth protection. U.S. Coin Capital provides physical gold and silver coins delivered directly to our clients. You can reach us at 1-800-878-2646, uscoincapital.com.
Central Time, where we are right now in the Power Hour. Dave Krieger with you, and of course, concluding the segment here, we have Morgan Lorette. He is got a book out called Guns, Girls, and Greed. I was a Blackwater mercenary in Iraq. He was first deployed to Iraq in 2003 to provide security for the first aerial supply route in Iraq at Talil Air Base, which was the staging point for the Jessica Lynch rescue. I'm sure you remember that. He joined Blackwater in 2004, was sent to Iraq to protect diplomats, participating in hundreds of sorties, combat missions, rather. Protecting the Regime Crimes Liaison Office, so that's a mouthful right there. They were the ones that gathered evidence for the trials of Saddam Hussein. And of course, he completed an undergrad degree in 2007 at Northern Arizona University, commissioned as an Army intelligence officer. In 2009, he deployed to Iraq, where his team fed reports to Chelsea Bradley Manning. Then ended up at WikiLeaks, and he left the Army as a captain. He received a Master's of International Banking and Finance in 2013 at Tufts University, assisting the FBI in convicting Matt Marshall of fraud in 2022 by debunking his proof that he worked for the CIA. Wow. Morgan Lorett, that's a heavy-duty resume there, sir.
Well, thanks for having me. I feel like Forrest Gump when people read it. I was also at the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. I ran the marathon that year. So, you know, life is just odd.
You know, and a lot of people said that that was staged. And I'm like, oh, please. I mean, I know there were people there that saw that thing go off. Somebody intended to commit terrorist act. I mean, it's just the way it is. I mean, you don't just set a bomb off. I mean, I'm putting the tinfoil hat away on this one. I'm sorry. It's not working for me. So what happened? I mean, you were there. You saw all this was going on. How did you assist, or did you assist, or what did you do?
No, so I had just finished the race, and they turn you back around towards the finish line, and I heard a pop, and my buddy said, oh, I think that's a bomb. And I was like, I've heard bombs. That wasn't a bomb. I heard a second pop, and I said, look, if those were bombs, everybody would be running this way with their cell phones to their ear. And I would say 30 seconds later, everybody was running our way, cell phones up. And I said, holy crap, dude, that was a bomb. Get out of town. Because they cordon and search, right? They close everything off, nobody in or out. My wife and I, even after a marathon, ran to the nearest train station to get out of Boston, got literally the last orange line out of Boston to, I think, Malden, and got in our car and got home. But my buddies got stuck there for 6-7 hours. It was cold. I mean, it was crazy. It was not staged. I will ensure that. That was definitely not staged.
Yeah, that's the scary part about it, because, you know, people look at 9/11, they look at false flag attacks. I mean, as a Blackwater mercenary, you're a private contractor, right?
Yeah. So we got tasked. Well, let's start at the beginning. So what happened was, is we went into Iraq, Department of Defense, military operation, and then we elected an interim government. They gave that country back to Iraq, or back to that interim government, and then it became a Department of State mission, a diplomatic mission, right? Well, there's nobody to protect diplomats. They have a security service, but they're very small. So what do? Well, they started reaching out, and Blackwater was one of those ones that said, hey, we can do this. We can get guys on the ground. They have combat experience. We'll get them over there and protect diplomats. So we would go from, you know, point A to point B. For the regime crimes liaison team, we would take evidence up to where Saddam Hussein was hanged, called JSS Justice, and then to the court system, and we'd help gather evidence. And really, every day that you got somebody from point A to point B and didn't get yourself or them blown up was a win. So then we go to the pool and just start drinking heavily.
Oh, no. That's a downside of the whole equation, too. It's like, whew, that was close. Let's go get a beer.
Let's do that again tomorrow, hungover.
Wow. But see, that's the thing, you know, is your total aptitude, your perception of things could kind of be dulled if you were doing this on a regular basis. But every day they seem to put their hat on and just go right back to work again.
Yeah, I call it the combat mullet. It's party in the front, or business in the front and party in the rear. You know, that was every day. You just wake up and you do your business, and then, you know, it's time to go grab some beers and relax.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine you had to do that, and I'm not sure how the beer was over there. I mean, did they serve American beer over there?
You could get Corona, but most of it was European beer. But it had sat on these pallets. You know, it's 120 degrees in Baghdad. It sits on these pallets, and it was probably the grossest beer on the planet. But, you know, it got the job done.
I'm sure it did. So how you got to meet Jessica Lynch?
I didn't. You know, the crazy thing is, during the ground offensive, you have to remember, I had a pager back in 2003, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like we had this communication that we knew what was going on. I thought J-Lo had been killed. Like, that's how crazy everything was. So the C-130s came in. They dropped off the little birds. And then the special operations guys came in at some point. And then they just took off. And then a couple hours, they came back. And I was like, oh, well, that's kind of weird and fun. And then they had security taking her on a C-17 out of there. I didn't even know it was Jessica Lynch until I got home. We just happened to have the first Combat Army Surgical Hospital in Iraq. So it staged out of there, brought her in, and then took her out to Germany.
Amazing. Now, how is it that you had a team that fed Bradley Manning, now known as Chelsea Manning? How did you manage to do that? I mean, isn't this the one where they took pictures of all the caskets on the airplane?
No. This was so I was stationed in Copcash, which is just south of Baghdad, in 2009, 2010 as an Army intel officer. Now, first things first, the intel that we got was terrible. The war was winding down. All of our sources knew all of our other sources. They would just come in and parrot the same thing over and over again, as we found out. So we would write all these intel reports and send them up to Cop Hammer, which is a combat outpost where Chelsea Bradley Manning was hanging out. So we would literally just send that right to him, and then he would download it on a disc and send it off to WikiLeaks, apparently. It was a weird time to be in Iraq, because nobody wanted to be there. The Iraqis didn't want us to be there. And then you had these horrible intel reports. So my command said, hey, don't go on WikiLeaks and check out those reports. I said, yeah, you don't worry. I don't have to. I sent like half of them.
So the book, Guns, Girls, and Creed, agreed. Where the guns, I understand. I mean, was there arms shipments being stolen and things that we hear about, that Blackwater was involved in, you know, recovery of stolen weaponry? Or, I mean, how did that work? I mean, they gave all those weapons to the Taliban when Biden pulled us out of Afghanistan. That was a strange set of circumstances. They should have taken all that. Were you ever involved in anything post-Afghanistan with Blackwater?
No. So I did 2004 through the end of 2005, so about 18 months. And they would issue us guns, but you could get guns on the local market all day. You could get an AK-47, you could get pistols. Remember those like silver and nickel-plated AK-47s that Saddam used to? Yeah, we had one of those. It was going around the man camp, or our little tent. So yeah, they would have
it. He said man cave.
Yeah, our man cave. But yeah, I mean, guns is always the big topic of conversation. What are you carrying today? What are your optics? What are you, you know, going out? You got trigger time. Where'd you shoot? You know, it was just always something about guns. It's Iraq.
So, I mean, but the thing is that, you know, it's like they were asking you whether you had a 7.62 by 39 or a 5.56 NATO. I mean, any of that was all part of the conversation.
Oh, 100%. But, that's not the sexy stuff. The sexy stuff is, do you have a Trijicon? Do you have a Seymour sight? Do you have a boomstick on the front of it? Do you have a saw? Is it a parasaw? Is it the snub nose? I mean, it was just always, when you're working with a bunch of former special operations guys, I'm not one of them, but they were. I mean, they know their stuff back and forth. Yeah. I was like, I've got the black one, and I pull on this thing, and little projectiles come out.
Yeah, see, what I think Trijicon, I'm like, ooh, that's some pretty high-end stuff, because I've studied it, so I know. But anyway, the funny thing about it is the title of this, where did you get it, and why did you use that title?
Well, it's a beautiful alliteration, but
I understand really, that. But I mean, there had to be some inference to why you use that alliteration.
Yeah. So guns, we hit on greed. Everybody wants to say we weren't mercenaries, but we could have went back over there as an E4, as an E5, making $50,000-$60,000 a year. We raised our hand to go back over because they were paying us, and they were paying us handsomely, $550 a day to start. I mean, as a 23-year-old kid from small town USA, that was more money than I'd ever seen in my life. So I had to go out and blow it on a Land Rover, of course, because that's what you do. And then the girls part, always a topic of conversation. And there are so many people that were buying hookers, and they would come back and they would tell us these stories about the hookers that they bought. And a lot of them made it into the book. My wife was like, oh my God, are you telling another one of those stories? But that's what you talk about. When you're bored, in Iraq, it's 99% boredom. So you feel the boredom, you talk about guns, you talk about girls, you talk about how much money you're making. So, like, girls is always the hot topic. And there are some degenerates in this book. It is hilarious.
I mean, you're talking about degenerates, meaning people in your own unit?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, look, anybody that volunteered after Fallujah, right, the four Blackwater contractors got killed in Fallujah March 2004. Anybody that went over there and volunteered to go work for Blackwater after that probably had a couple of screws loose, myself included. I mean, I'm saying it about me. So it was just a bunch of, like, young men making way too much money trying to figure out what to do with it and how to just survive the day.
Yeah, I mean, I could only be that lucky if I was fortunate enough to go to work for Air America during Vietnam, but I wasn't. So, you know, I've been around the block too, just like you, but you got higher rank than I did. So, and you were actually there, boots on the ground, which that's more stress, more intensity. And then when you look at the deviant behavior, and then now, did any of the inner workings of the military, because there were several women that were serving that actually claimed that they were sexually assaulted. Did you hear stories like that?
I didn't hear stories about that, and it didn't run through the Blackwater group. Here's right. What happened is that we would go to the pool. We'd be drinking. Military people can't be drinking. You get a little bit of liquid courage. People would go start hitting on the military females that were hanging out at the pool. And then, like, as a female over there, you kind of have your pick of the litter, right? You don't go for the runt. Like, you're not going for Morgan. You're going for the big, burly Navy SEAL guy. And then people would get in fights over girls. Mm. And it's like, you know, if you were back at home and you were fighting over this girl, everybody would say, boy, she's the overseas beauty queen. Back home, she might be a 4. You guys are fighting over a 9 over here. So it was just always something. There was always something. And I say, like, it was normal because nothing was abnormal at the time.
Yeah, I can understand that, being in Blackwater, because, I mean, you were constantly on your toes on a regular basis because, I mean, you were in the forefront. You were aware of what happened in Fallujah, and you didn't want to become another statistic. And I get that. The greed part of the book, where does that come in?
Oh, just
money. The idea of being get paid over there, and that's
yeah.
It?
I can't tell you how many times, like, you know, what did you buy on Amazon? What do you have in ship to you? What do you like? People, here's what contractors do, or did at least, is I went over there. I didn't have a plan, so I make this money. I come home on leave. I buy a Land Rover. I blow through all my money. What do I have to do? I have to go do another contract. Then I come home, I blow through all the money. And this is really like people coming home saying, oh, I got this new Cadillac and this new Harley Davidson. And we'd say, oh, that's why you were supposed to be gone for 2 months and you only lasted 3 weeks. Like you were broke. So we spent it as fast as we got it, for sure.
Wow. And now you're getting residuals off the book.
Oh, yeah, I'm making tens of dollars.
Dizzy, that's, you and I both know that it's nice to put it in writing, but, you know, because I've written 8 books. And the thing is that and 50 cents will get you a cup of coffee. So the bigger part of being a mercenary, I mean, what was the toughest thing you had to face as a mercenary, per se?
I mean, the stories, I could tell you 100 stories, but every day we would go out into the red zone, right? And it was just, you know, 12, 13 guys coming together, figuring out where you're going to drive this route. Is the road blocked off? Is it not? I wish I could say we had GPS back then. Even if we did, the GPS didn't exactly have Baghdad on its road, you know, saying, take a left. Oh, there's a car bomb. Take a right. Like, so it was just us kind of figuring out what to do on a daily basis. But the biggest threat was always car bombs. So when you're driving in Baghdad, these drivers are the worst drivers ever. Like, Boston's got nothing on Baghdad. And I lived in Boston. You guys are terrible drivers. but if a car is screaming up on you at 30, 40, 50 miles an hour, you have to make that split-second decision. Is this a car bomb? Is this a threat? Is it not? And you have to be able to engage that based on kind of your moral compass. You don't have rules of engagement that say when the car gets to 40 meters, you can engage, right? So it was literally, this car was coming up on us, this red car, which is odd for over there. It was coming up on our convoy. And the first time I took my weapon off a safe and I just started like throwing rounds in front of it. You don't want to like shoot the people if they're just bad drivers. So you put some rounds in front of it, hoping they stop. And then you try to hit the grill to stop the vehicle. But it is, everything slows down and you get tunnel vision. And then as soon as you're done, everything jolts back to real time. And it's just the weirdest thing. It's got to be like, it's got to be like you see on those movies where like everything goes in slow mo and you're like
the Sam Peckinpah moment. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, holy crap. And then, you know, we saw cars flipping, kids flying out of cars, and it like slows down. And then all of a sudden you're back to real life and it's like, holy crap. Now you have to react, right? You had your second and a half to say, oh, well, that was interesting. Now you got to actually do something.
So now what did the red car do? Did it keep coming?
Well, so I was in the lead vehicle. The lead vehicle pulled forward, so I couldn't see it anymore. I was looking out the side window. My Top Gunner engaged it, and by the time the rest of the convoy went, the car had stopped itself. So my buddy was like, how many rounds did you shoot? And I was like, 7, 8? And he's like, where'd they hit? And I was like, when we turned, I didn't see where like the last two impacted. And he's like, well, you probably just killed a baby. I was like, come on, man, come on. But that's how we would mess with each other, right? Like dark humor, coping mechanism, just get through the day.
Wow. And I mean, that's how intense it got over there, is because every day was a big risk of life and limb.
Oh, 100%. And we had Blackwater contractors that, you know, they got killed. We had the military. We never coordinated with the military. So when people say, was anybody in charge? No. That's why we couldn't win anyway. So the military would do their missions. We would do our missions. If we ran into each other on the road, they had more firepower, so we'd give them their distance. I did get into a car accident where one of our vehicles smashed into another one, and big army was coming down that road, and they held traffic off so we could kind of limp it back into the green zone. But there was no coordination. And if anything happened with security contractors, you didn't have anybody you could call. You could call back and say, hey, I need a convoy to come out here and get me, but you couldn't call big army. There's no air support. And our longer missions, we wouldn't even have radio contact. So imagine you're just like bebopping down the road trying to get to Al-Hilla. And it's like, well, when we get close to the next embassy, we'll radio them in and let them know that we're close. Like it's insane looking back on it. But at the time, it felt normal.
Yeah, well, there is no normal over there in a war zone. I mean, it feels normal when there's nothing going on, but when there's something going on, it's anything but normal. And I mean, now the bigger question, and people would probably want to know, have you ever had to shoot to kill? Is that memory still there? If you did.
Yes. Well, so we were shoot and scoot, right? We are not the military. We're not going in. We're not clearing out buildings. So, I mean, I shot quite a bit. But it was always at vehicles coming, and then we would just drive off. And the good part about that is I have no idea. The bad part of that is I have no idea. And neither does anybody else. That's kind of the problem. There's a part in the book where our convoy ended up engaging a car, and one of the bullets skipped off the ground and ended up hitting an IP. Most of the time, the convoy doesn't even know what's going on. It's just one or two people at any given moment that says, oh, this is what happened, or that's what happened. And it's not like we were good at writing reports. Nobody wants to write reports. So we would just come back and, you know, crack a beer and say, hey, we survived another day.
Yeah. But the thing is that accountability factor was like non-existent.
Oh, 100%. And the rules of engagement were non-existent. What laws governed us was still fuzzy. They told us that we had diplomatic immunity. So if anything happened, they would whisk us out. And then the Blackwater guys would take that diplomatic passport from the State Department and try to get through all the lines at the airports. So they had to take those away because we're idiots. But so
you just whip the ID out, trying to, oh my God.
Yeah.
You just see that go down.
Yeah, no. Well, who do you work for? Oh, I work for the State Department, I swear. It's a very precarious situation because you don't know what laws govern you until something bad happens, and then all of a sudden every law governs you, and the government has a lot of your money to spend trying to prosecute you. You saw that in 2007 with Raven 23.
Yeah, that's the scary part, is all our tax dollars are going into something that we just kind of scratch your heads and wonder why we're there in the first place. Did it ever cross your mind that what happened and why you were in Iraq, and you look at the green zone, the red zone, and all this other stuff and go, wow, this shock and awe thing that started it all. Did anything ever cross your path to indicate that shouldn't have been there in the first place, that there was no weapons of mass destruction? I mean, did any of that ever cross your path?
Every day across the path, because you could walk by the green zone had every general and every field grade officer walking around without their body armor on. And the war was being fought by little small pockets of like infantry guys. And these guys were sitting up there, you know, sipping fine scotch in their recliners, acting like they were winning the war. And the news would say, oh, we're making great progress. And the generals would say, we're doing great. And then, you know, a car bomb, we had a garbage truck full of explosives blow up at one of our gates. And I was thinking, I don't think we're actually winning. So the whole weapons of mass destruction thing, like I did the regime crimes liaison office. He had chemical weapons. He used them on the Kurds in like 1988. We know he had those, but it definitely got blown out of proportion to the point that everybody wanted to say, oh, he's going to get nukes. He was nowhere close to nukes. And
no
you could
doubt.
Just see it.
Yeah, see, this reminds me of Good Morning Vietnam when they bombed Jimmy Waz, you know? I mean, I'm just looking at this thing going, okay, they covered it up. And you got, you know, Tweedledee and Tweedledum over there editing all that news copy. And, I mean, they literally censored a lot of what we the people were hearing. I mean, I can only assume that this is exactly the kind of stuff that goes on over in Israel and Ukraine as well, wouldn't you think?
Oh, 100%. I guarantee that the progress that they're making is the same progress we made in Afghanistan and Iraq for 20 years.
Wow. Morgan Lorette, thank you so much for joining us. We're out of time for today, folks. We hope you got something useful out of this conversation, like exactly what truth and what lies there are, and you have to be the judge. You have to weed past all that. In the interim, thank you so much for joining us, and we will be back tomorrow, of course, for our Tuesday edition here at the Power Hour. In the meantime, God bless you and God bless the United States of America. See you tomorrow.
Harmful organisms are everywhere affecting your health and well-being. Fortunately, there's a solution. Paratrax is a unique formula designed to help create an environment that's hostile to invading organisms. Made with a blend of herbs and other natural ingredients such as wormwood, which has often been used in traditional medicine as a dewormer. If unwanted organisms are affecting your health, Paratrax can help bring it all back in balance. Order today from thepowermill.com or call 877-817-9829. Are you tired of trying to figure out how to get all your fruits and vegetables into your busy lifestyle? OptiVita Complete Essentials provides you with 22 whole food vitamins and minerals, 29 fruits and vegetables, probiotics, antioxidants, and botanicals for ultimate health and nutrition. 30 individual packs, now less than $3 per day. Get your OptiVita Complete Essentials by calling 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com.
I don't know where to start. There's so many products you guys offer. I think one of the first things I ever ordered from you guys was your clay. The clay is miraculous. I could not do without that. And the charcoal, you know, you can get yourself in a bathtub to kind of help take the toxins out. So just those two alone, but I could go on to the OptiVita Silver Lozenges. Of course, then the Oregaresp and the P73, the oil of oregano, and your Vitamir toothpaste. Again, I could go on and on and on.
Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
My husband is a welder by trade, but he grinds his welding products. And he doesn't wear a helmet or a mask to do that. And he had this cruddy stuff in his lungs, and it just wasn't going away. And I heard you one time talking about the Sera enzyme for the lungs. And my goodness, I mean, he can breathe so much easier. And I don't hear that crud in his lungs. Thank you so very much.
To find out more about this product or others like it, go to our website at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com. Call 877-817-9829. That number again is 877-817-9829. Jay's standing by to take your call. Now more than ever, we need your support. Buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.